Good morning, everyone. My name is Joyce Perry. I'm an alcoholic from Columbus, Ohio. I'd like to ask for a moment of silence and gratitude for the AA recoveries of the past 70 years. Speakers. And now I'd like to introduce the first speaker. We have Leonard D. from Illinois. Oh, is it Michigan? I forgot. I think I made a mistake. I think he's from Michigan. Sorry. Sorry about that.
I'm great to die. My name is Leonard, and I'm an alcoholic. And I live in Ishpeming, Michigan. And I hope it wasn't untimely of me, but I had breakfast this morning, and sitting next to me was Bob, the MC of the show last night. And I thanked him for all of you for what he did. It would be remiss of me to say, not humbly, that I am probably as well suited to speak on this panel as you can get. I have lived with a black belt Al-Anon of 43 years experience. I have been married to her for over 50 years, and I have been in love with her since I've been 13. Now enough of the maudlin stuff. I'm a thumper. I don't apologize for it. And so I'm going to take you immediately to Dr. Silkworth's doctor's opinion. You know, the doc never really cared too much about our drinking. He cared an awful lot about our thinking and our mind and how our mind just does not quite click. I'm a writer, and I like to write about sandboxes. My sandbox, your sandbox, AA sandbox, Al-Anon sandbox, everybody's sandbox. And I thought everybody had to come into my sandbox and play by my rules. Yeah, that's sick. I know that now. I didn't know that then. And so when Silky asked me to come out of my sandbox and get into other sandbox, I didn't know how to do that. And when I got out of my sandbox, I thought I was dead. I had nothing in me. I had nothing to identify myself with. And for the first 12 years of my life, I was awkward, shy, and I still am a retiring person, very introverted. There's an awful lot of people who know me real well and think, yeah, Len. But it is true, I am. And Silky said I should get over this. And I couldn't until I took alcohol. And when I took alcohol into my system, I immediately didn't care whose sandbox I was in. We were going to do some very lively things. And I tried to do that for a number of years. In fact, I started drinking when I was 12. And to go real quickly, I quit when I was 17 when I fell in love with Phyllis. That's the black belt Al-Anon. And I quit drinking for 2 years. And I went back again when I was 19. And I quit when I was 26. And so I have a lot of sobriety. In fact, Phyllis and I were here in 1965. For the international. Is there anybody here in the audience who was here in 65? No, okay, all you newcomers. But on page 42 of our book, it's an odd book, and when I talk about it, I tell people, read the black, ignore the white. And the black is very succinct, very correctly, because it's not talking about drinking. And everybody says, well, it's talking about drinking. No, it isn't talking about drinking. Silky established that a long time ago. Even the 25 people who wrote this crazy book, they knew what they were talking about. It wasn't about drinking. It was about changing our thinking and changing this mental concept we have. And by the way, I better get this thing off right away or I'll talk for 21 minutes and tick a lot of people off up here. And so anyway, we thank you for stopping. It says, if my thinking is going to change, some drastic things have to take place. And they use the word drastic. And to use the word drastic to an alcoholic is like throwing a nuclear weapon into a sandbox. Don't rattle the newcomer. Don't upset the newcomer. I think we should all hit him over the head with 2x4s or hit him with a ball bat. Do anything, but please upset him or her. And then it goes on to say, spiritual principles are going to solve all my problems. Not a little bit, not prayer, not novenas, not going to church, but spiritual principles. If I adopt them into my life, things are going to change. Live and let live. My problem has always been, I have been in a state of continuous conflict with everything. I've been in conflict with you, with me. In fact, my major conflict is always with Wah. The ability for you and I, or for me, to come into your sandbox and play by your rules means I have to definitely remove the conflict, and I don't know how to do that. I don't know how to remove conflict from my life. I don't know how. I would love to be able to stand up here and say, you know, I got the answer. Well, I do have the answer. It's in the big book. But I personally don't have it. I got to practice the answer. I got to practice how to not be in conflict with you. I met Bill in 1965 here. And to let you know how easy it is for me to stick my foot in my mouth, we were over at New York, and we were at a GSR workshop type thing. And he said what he had to say. And I walked out one of the side doors, and I was waiting for all the other people to get the books autographed and shake hands with God. And I had just walked out of the room. And Bill happened to walk out the same door I had walked out, and Bill, of course, I'm small. Most everybody in the world, except for my wife, is bigger than me. Not wider, bigger. And so, here's this guy come out. He's 9'3". And he, hi, kid. Hi, Bill. And I'm sitting down like they are over there, and God, I wish I could do that again. Anyway, Bill starts talking to me, and you talk about conflict. My opening words was, well, Bill, I've never really been too much impressed with you because Dr. Bob was my first sponsor. And, yeah, right, extract the number 9. And in the process, I did fall in love with Bill's persona, and I have to admit, I did. Because Bill talked about Dr. Bob and how their conflicts were always present. Now, thank you for sharing that, because I will listen to people with, well, it must happen on your 91st day, because you've been going to meetings for 90 days now, gone to at least one a day, and at your 91st day, you become perfect. And I look at you and I say, you know, I hate to tell you this, gang, but I got 43 years. I'm still crazier now. Please, please don't tell me how wonderful you are at 91 days. So we have this conflict, you know, and O'Brien, my. By the way, I don't want you to get fresh, but if I go 19, you can hit me across the ass, and I'll sit down. Okay. Thank you, Joyce. And so O'Brien was trying to teach me. He said, Leonard, you need to understand everybody's like you. Oh, God. Oh, not everybody in this room, I hope, wants to shoot me. Please, I hope there's one loving person out there that'll rescue my ass and get between me and thee. Let's get back to conflict control. If you are in control of my life, I will hate you. If OB would have allowed himself to become, he was my first sponsor, if he would allow himself to become completely control of my life, I would learn to hate him. Now, I realize it's fashionable in today's world of AA to listen to your sponsor and do everything he says and blah, blah, blah. The line we have today, that's a crock. That is really a crock. If my sponsor doesn't have some appealing to me, I might honor him with, but I'm not going to get a hell of a lot done, am I? Because I'm not going to do what he asked me to do, because in my heart of hearts I know it's not spiritually well-keeping to my sobriety. So I have to let him be or her be anything she or he wants to be. It's not my job to play God in anybody's life. Nor is it your job to play God in my life. But do you have something that will meet me halfway? See, if I'm in conflict with you and see a crime, boy, if a priest walks in now, he's going to say, what in the hell is going on? But if we got a cross here, and between me and thee, and we meet in the center of that cross, you're not in control, nor am I. Thank you. Very few people would ever agree with me, but can I have that down in writing so Phyllis can see it? Inside of this place that we have of conflict and control is, by the way, I think I told you right. I can't stand people who use the word who when whom is correct. And I really hate to hear people say whom when you're talking in the singular. It would be who. Say, whom is in control is correct. And I do sponsor people who are weird, really weird. And they'll scratch their ass and say, well, Leonard, if I'm not going to be in control, and they are not going to be in control, who in the hell is in control? And this person had been in AA with relative sobriety for over 20 years. Guys, I've got a concept here. Yeah, it's coming real clear. Why don't you turn to page 45? Page 45 of the book Alcoholics Anonymous makes clear who is going to be in control and who is singular now, not whom, but who. The book Alcoholics Anonymous, in its all its clarity, has anybody here ever just thought to read to the family? Just thought about it. I'm not asking you to be that drastic to read it. Thank you. You didn't see too many male hands go up, but that's all right. Yeah. It's called ego, dear. It's called ego. Sure, call me a liar. Go ahead, fellas. In the family, it is, you are my family. Phyllis and my children. We have four children. One is in AA. 1988. Doing that. I'm only concerned about my years. I don't care about anybody else's. But he has the same sobriety date as my wife. Not the same date. Like I said, Phyllis got 43. 1988 to 2005. Was that, what is it, 17? 17 years. I'm the writer. Phyllis is the mathematician. But Bill was a sobriety baby, the one that's in AA. And he, all the kids talk to me. No, I won't go there. Sometimes my mouth really does run off far quicker than the brain does. But sometimes God in his infinite wisdom, shut up. Don't say it. And he just did that to me. Suffice it to say, my children come to me because they know I'm not going to resolve their problems. And they know I'm not going to resolve their problems because I believe if you're going to sponsor in your home. Have the person whom you're sponsoring, whom I'm sponsoring, come into my home. See my life. Sometimes you're going to have to stay with me for 2 or 3 weeks, a month, when you're new. I feed you warm water and honey. I am not going to give you sauerkraut. I think that's vicious. And I would never do it. And that's as close as I'll ever come to classy by vicious. Now, my children have seen alcoholism in all stages, from Korsakoff's to a man sober 43 years, failing to work is step two. We all have those places in our lives that does not allow us to be God. I thank God for that. I thank God that I still suffer from this disease. I still thank him that I don't know enough to come to the center of that cross, but I want to tell you how to live. If I'm telling you how to live, don't make it a small tap either, Joyce. Hit it. There's a lot back there, and I have to know you've struck me. Inside of this insanity, I throw you out of your sandbox. That's sad. I don't allow you. Isn't that a horrible choice of words? Correct, though. I don't allow you to be you in your sandbox. God, that is so ugly. And we wonder why people, they don't reason. In fact, I found page 62. If you ever are in Ishpeming on Thursday night, I belong to a nice big book group. It is a nice book. Believe me, you should read it sometime. But in page 62, it says, we step on their toes and they retaliate. Show me a drunk anywhere in the world who's ever stepped on somebody's toes. We push them over, we bulldoze them over, we stomp on their head. Are you dead yet? But we'll never step on your toes. In your sandbox, I do that. No wonder people avoided my sandbox. And they did. I was 15 years sober, almost 15 years sober, lacking a month or two, because I don't know the date. God and I decided to shake hands with God. God had been extending his hand for a long time, and I said, no, I don't need you. I got AA. Who the hell needs God? And obviously, if you get the arithmetic right, I've had a 28-year relationship with a thing I call God. I would not insult him. Page 83 says I don't insult my God. So I don't call him HP, higher power, Lake Superior, blue skies, or anything else. I call him God. God and I have a nice relationship. He tells me what to do. On almost all things, I concur and I will do it. Sometimes with heated debate, strong debate, and there's one thing he's told me to do I still won't do. And that is not going to be talked about here. I've talked about it with my sponsor. I've talked about it with my sponsor's wife, and we all agree God is probably right. But I'll be damned if I can do it. I'm not that spiritually inclined yet. What is it? What is this strange relationship I have with God in God's sandbox? See, God has a sandbox too. It's a place. In your hatred, in my hatred, to see in my sandbox, there has been tremendous hatred. I was at one time a very violent man. I would never, ever strike a female. Never have. My violence does not run towards slapping people around. But my violence does take its way into take away your breath. In your kindness, that you don't own, in your places that you don't seek, in that world that not just drunks, but humanity rest, that place that says you are not welcomed. There's nobody in this room that does not know or I have experienced that place. It is not living nor dying. It is not allowing somebody else to breathe or to live that brings us here today. It is your ability to love me. Thank you.
Thank you, Leonard. I'd like to announce the next speaker, who is Connie from Arizona.
Thank you, Joyce. Thank you, Leonard. There are a couple people standing up in the back. If you have a seat next to you, you want to raise your hand and let the people that are standing up in the back. There's an empty seat next to these people that have their arms raised. Okay. I'm still an alcoholic. My name is Connie Unger, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm delighted to be here. I'm delighted to be anywhere. Wow. I'm trying to tell myself this is just another meeting. I come from Sedona, Arizona. I got sober in Baltimore. In the Baltimore area. My home group is the Clear the Air group in Sedona, Arizona, and also the Chrysalis group, I'm greedy, in Sedona, Arizona. And my sobriety date is June 30th, 1975. Thank you for my life. And thank you for throwing me this wonderful birthday party. This kind of speaking is not something that I usually do. I'll do what I know how to do, which is tell you a little bit about what I was like, what happened, and what it's like today and touch on the topic. I do have a watch. Okay. 30 years ago today, I sat in a treatment center on the outside of Baltimore, 2 days dry. It was a treatment center for people like me that didn't have a job or money, insurance, a place to live, and people with no hope. And I was 30 years old, and it felt like my life was over. And I had only drunk for about 11 years. I started drinking in the last year or two of college. And when I left college, it was the first time I was completely out on my own, and it was Katie bar the door. And I just took to it, and within a couple months, I was drinking daily. And I was not drinking daily because I thought I had any problems. I was drinking daily because I could. And I was drinking because I loved it. And it did good things for me. I had alcoholics in my family. I didn't know to call them that. I just knew that they were self-centered and weak-willed, and they probably shouldn't drink so much. But when I put alcohol inside me, it didn't feel inside me the way it looked on the outside of them. And I could handle it a lot. And I could drink most guys under the table. Not you guys, I know, but I could drink most guys under the table. And I was very proud of myself. I thought that had to do with my maturity. I thought it was a sign that I would never have the kind of problem that my mother had. And it was exactly the opposite. The fact that I love it, the fact that I could handle it, the fact that I could drink lots to get ready for the party, go to the party, pour everybody else their drinks. Of course, that meant I could pour myself a couple extra. Drive everyone else home and then have a nightcap or 10. I thought that just really meant that I would never have a problem. I don't have time to tell you my story. I wish I could just like mind meld with you, do a Vulcan mind meld and just pass it out to you. But it was wonderful and it was horrible. I think anybody sitting here sober knows exactly what I'm talking about. I loved it. It took me wonderful places, and it took me to hell. And I can't even recount the number of places it took me. When I graduated from college, instead of getting a real job, I decided to become an international flight attendant. And I lived in Midtown Manhattan, and I flew all over the world. And from the other side of the bar, every place in the world looks the same. You know, I've been around the world. In the course of my drinking, I gradually crossed over all of my own moral boundaries. And I did things that I didn't want to do, that I didn't believe in. I became a cheat and a liar. I became much more promiscuous than any of my uptight upbringing would have remotely entertained. I began to not only drink really close to the flight, but I drank on the flight. I steal booze. I would go around with miniatures in my pocket because I had to drink all the time. In really a few short years, I had to drink daily. In the beginning, it was fun, as I said. And then I drank to be sort of normal. And then I drank because if I didn't drink, I felt really sick. I drank because I had to. And in the end, I drank because I couldn't live with it and I couldn't live without it. I did a couple of geographics in my drinking. I'll just tell you, especially for the women in this room, one of the places that alcohol took me was a tabletop abortion in Harlem, New York, when abortions were illegal. And that was one of many things that I survived. I don't know how I survived. And it was absolutely my drinking that got me there. One of the geographics I took was, after that experience in Harlem, was out to California to hit the single scene and, you know, be free and party and see if I could find Mr. Right or something. I remember the sensation of just looking for something and I didn't know what it was. You know, I started drinking, I was feeling good and I was feeling energy and I was feeling full of life. And as I began to drink, it began to take all of that away and I didn't know who I was or where I wanted to go or anything. But I was looking for something. And my geographic to California didn't work. After I'd been there a few years, I met a guy that I used to drink with, and he lived in the outskirts of Baltimore, starting this new town called Columbia, and invited me to move out there with him. And I decided I would do that because I didn't have anything else going. And he and I drank, and we drank. And I commuted from Baltimore to New York City, and from there I flew to Europe and Tel Aviv and around the world again. And I was really sick, and I started missing work. And when the flight's gone for 2 weeks, and you're an hour late, you can't just arrive, you know? They start noticing, and they start getting sort of ticked off. And I started getting these little notices from work. And I started having these mysterious things called blackouts, I learned later, where I would be on the way to the airport and somehow I would find myself someplace else and I didn't know why I couldn't get to the airport. I would lose the airport. I think I need to shorten this up. The main thing is that quiet desperation of the soul that I was feeling, the self-hatred, the not knowing who I was and where I was going, not knowing what my life was about. I didn't really think that drinking was part of it, although I was drinking 24/7. I had it with me everywhere because I had to. I began to try to stop drinking, and I began to look for help, and I went to a problem drinkers group. I went to a doctor that gave me B12 shots and a lecture. I tried to white knuckle it. I did geographics. I did it on my own. I had assigned a relative or friend to be my babysitter and watch me. And somehow I always kept drinking. And I took leaves of absence from my job. And I was scared to go to work, not just because I was missing work so much, but I was drunk on the job all the time. And I wish I could say that I was sorry for you flight passengers out there. But I wish I could say that I was really scared that your lives were in my hand and that I wouldn't be able to get you out if there was an emergency. But the truth was I was afraid I would get caught. And that's alcoholism for you. One of the things I would do, I was so ashamed of myself, was try to go away and hide out. And I would hide away out in fancy hotels at first and then they get cheaper and cheaper. And I had taken this series of leaves of absence from my job, which ended up being about 9 months altogether. So I hadn't worked. I hadn't earned any money in 9 months. And I was staying in, actually it was Brown's Motel, for those of you in that area, up on Route 40. And the problem with them was the price was right, but they didn't have telephones in the room. And I had been exposed to a couple of AA meetings, and I decided that in the last gasp attempt, rather than trying to kill myself, which was a very serious consideration in my case, that I would try one more time to make a call. And so I had to, there were two things that I needed at this motel. One is I had to have a phone in the room, and the other was it had to have a soda machine so that I could mix my rot gut vodka with some kind of soda to try to keep it down, because that was an issue. And when I got to this motel, I called Alcoholics Anonymous, and there was somebody on the other end of the line. It was Ann and Sue, and I didn't even know where I was. I had to give them the phone number on the phone, and they called that number to ask at the hotel desk where this place was. And they came to 12-step me. And I remember begging them to pour that bottle of booze out because I was so afraid that I would pick it up and drink it. I was just so powerless. And they took me and they found a flop house for a couple of nights, and they came back and they visited me. And in a couple of days, they found me a place that would take people like me who didn't have any money, didn't have any resources at all. And I had just started taking women. You know, I guess before that date in 1975, women hadn't been alcoholics. But I was really lucky to have gotten in then. And I walked in and I looked around to see if the place was up to my specifications, and I asked them if I could get a job and a place to live. And they said, we'll get you a newspaper. And my life started over there, and I learned about the disease of alcoholism. I learned that if I thought it was bad, it was going to get worse. I, who didn't even know how to live for a few hours without drinking, managed to string a couple of days together before I left there. And I left that treatment center with 14 days dry. I left it with a meeting schedule. I didn't have a place to live. I had moved out on my boyfriend who was didn't really want me to get sober. And everything changed since then. That's an amazing to me that it was 30 years ago. When I think about it like this, and I'm so grateful for these chances to think about it, I just can't imagine getting here from there. I can't imagine being alive. The topic that we've been asked to touch on today, live and let live, to me was something very, very simple in the beginning. It meant me take care of my business and let you take care of your business. I really needed things simple at that time. I work my program, you work your program. I get to find my own God in my own way, in my own time, and you get to do it your way. If I want to stay sober, I get to choose to work the steps, and you get to do that. If we have different cultures or different languages or different political views, all that was something that I had to set aside. If somebody wanted to get sober, I had to learn how to let that go. If they didn't want to get sober, I had to learn how to let that go. One of the early things on, I tried to 12-step my own mother, and of course, I didn't even stay sober myself. So that just kind of goes to show how well that works. And that was enough for me for a long time, but as I've been thinking about this topic, it means a lot more to me than that. It doesn't mean to turn a blind eye. This alcoholic would use those kinds of things to avoid things that frightened me or issues I didn't want to have to deal with. You know, Leonard was sharing a lot more about the difficulties of finding the middle ground and leaving the result up to the higher power, and which is, my God thinks that's okay to call him higher power, but... Since this is a live and let live, yeah, this feels like a regular AA meeting. That there were these ways in which, like when my home group would have what they were calling a group conscience look like a family fight to me, and I was scared to death, I'd go, oh, well, live and let live, don't say anything, you know. And I did not have the balance and the spiritual insight and the knowledge of the traditions and things like that that I needed to really enter into these things. But with guidance of people that have walked this path before me, I have learned that with input, with prayer and meditation and input from my sponsor and others who've been around a while, that there's a middle ground here, and that if I live, in sobriety and in a spiritual path as best I know how, one day at a time, and allow you to do the same, what comes out of that is up to God. And to me, if I'm practicing all of these steps in my life, that there are answers that come to me that says, okay, Connie, whether you want to or not, it's your responsibility to participate in this group action or conscience. It is your responsibility to reach out this person to this person who is suffering from alcoholism. It is your responsibility to set a limit with this person that is hurting yourself or somebody that you know. I don't just go, oh, well, you have to live and let live and do nothing. But the outcome is not up to me. And I think that's the thing that I would, one of the things I was getting from Leonard here, that is this this gift, this balance that I've got. So I feel so grateful that I'm an alcoholic, because if that's what it took for me to get here, to be willing, as only the dying become, and that's the only thing that would have gotten me to this place, that for my very life I have opened my mind to this program, to ideas that I did not believe in, that I did not think would work for me, that I did not want to entertain, and my whole life has changed. And I am very grateful to be here. Thank you for helping me stay sober.
Thank you, Connie. I'd now like to announce Eric P. from Illinois.
Morning, everybody. My name is Eric, and I'm an alcoholic. If I keep talking, you are going to understand that English is not my natural language. I'm from Central America, from Guatemala. I immigrated to the United States in 1976. This uncle of mine, my father's baby brother, he came to Guatemala, and he invited me to come to the United States. And I said yes, because the way we used to live in Guatemala was so poor. I never had doubts about come to the United States. So I said yes, I go with you. So he paid for the trip, for all the expenses, and when we get to the border, He hired somebody to help me to cross the river. I'm a real wetback. If there's anybody from the immigration department, sorry, but I kind of a drive already, you know. So we crossed the border, and everything came out the way we expected it. To celebrate, he bought a 24 of beer, and we start celebrating from that point until we get to the Austin, Texas. My oldest brother, half-brother, used to live there. So we continuing to celebrate until I was 38 years old when I came to AA. It's going to be 11 years when I decide to stop drinking. This is my second international convention. This is a very special for me. So was the other one too, because I don't know if I say that I'm from Plainfield, Illinois. Chicago was one of the cities who have to organize, or had the pleasure to organize, the Hispanic meeting in Minneapolis. And I was a chairperson back then. That was my first service in the international convention. This is my second one. I've been involved for about 10 years in general service in my area. And I'm so grateful to be here. Very much. After I've been drinking for 18 years, I understand that I had to do something. When I came from Guatemala, I had a girlfriend that I didn't know that she was pregnant. Her mother used to live in California, in L.A., and she came to the States first. But she didn't tell me that she was going to have a baby. So when she moved to emigrate to the States, she said, well, when you be there, I'm going to help you. She never helped me, so I came here with my uncle. When I was here, I called her. She lived with me for two, three years, and we had a baby, you know. That girl, she was so smart. In the first 2, 3 years, she took off with the baby. And not only with the baby, with somebody else too. She was so smart. I understand it now. Because my actual wife, she's sitting somewhere in there, she has to support this alcoholic for 15 years. You can think that she's not too smart, but she is. If you see it from my point of view, probably she is very smart. Because she is enjoying now what the other one is not going to. We've been married for 25 years. 4 girls. 1 grandkid. In my home, I see the 4 different personalities in my girls. The first one is aggressive. The second one, she's shy. The third one, she had a tick, nervous tick, that she, everything, when I start to screaming and yelling and do my show at home, she used to just jump and get nervous, turn into the wall, and not to talk to anybody. She wants to be alone. The last one, she is aggressive too. She speaks her mind every time when she could. That's the result of my home. Of this sickness that I didn't know what I had inside of me. Everybody knew that I was drunk. Everybody knew that I had problems. Everybody knew that I was a real good worker. I was a good father. My wife says so. I don't know. Everybody said that I had problems with the alcohol. But nobody told me what to do. Nobody said, go here, go there, because they don't know what to do. There's a lot of people out there still that they don't know that we exist. They don't know that the program works. They turn into something else because they don't know what to do with the guy that they have at home. So that would work that, so my wife, she didn't know what to do with me. Until one day, I was working on the switches at home. We were renting. We had an apartment with 2 bedrooms. I used to sleep in the bedroom right next to the fridge because I would, you know, it was so close to grab the beer and, you know. And then my wife and my 4 girls used to sleep in the other bedroom, a little bit bigger, but 5 people used to sleep there. So I was working on the switches, and then I said, well, you want to go with me to the hardware store? And she said, yes. So we went, and as soon as we walked in, this friend of mine, he came out, and he goes, you still drink, right? And I said, well, not the way we used to. And my wife said also, yeah, it's right. He doesn't drink every day now. He drinks only Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Yeah. That was enough for her. Yeah. So he grabs a little car from his home group, and he says, "Here, go to this place. They are going to help you." Luckily, now I say luckily, that my wife was with me. Yeah. I took the car, I put it right at my chest, in one corner of my chest, in my bedroom. I had four girls. The oldest one was 12 years back then. And I put the car right in the corner of the chest. 6 months later, when I had the water right up to here, she was bothering me every day. "Why don't you go to AA, you know? They might do something for you." I was afraid to go because I didn't want to start drinking. 6 months later, the car was still there. This afternoon I came from work, and I asked her, "Do you have some beers?" And she said, "Well, you didn't give me any money. That's why I didn't buy any." So I said, you going to eat?" "Yeah." So she put the food on the table. And then I went to get something to drink right at the corner of the street that I used to live. I came back. I poured one glass of beer. And I tried to eat a little here and there. I drank half of that glass. And then happened the most mysterious thing in my life. That's what I believe when they wrote about the guy that when Bill said that the room was illuminating, and I don't know if he was hallucinating or something, but so I was sitting right there on that table, and I start seeing the big screen. That's what I believe it. Before me, that's the whole life since I crossed the border. When I was sitting there, I was already dry. But that when the big screen started, my life started passing to me. My wife said that she sent the little girl, my little girl, to see that what was happening to me. And then my little girl came back to her and said, "Well, he's sitting there with his side to the wall. I don't know what he's seeing, but he's looking through the wall right there. Is he eating? No. No. Is he smoking? No. He's like a, well, that's the words that my little girl said. He's like a dumbass watching the wall right there." In my home group, the meeting started at 8 o'clock. There was 15 minutes to 8. I went to look for the car, and it was right there. That's him. Yeah. That was him. 6 months, the car was still there. My daughter used to play all over, 2-bedroom apartment, and the car was still there. So I took the car, I went to the meeting, and ever since I realized that this life is better without it. Now, sometimes when I'm trying to apply the program to my family, it doesn't work. I understand now that it's not going to work. The program is for me. When I try to, my wife practices it. When my daughter practices it. I realize that it's not the way that it's supposed to be done. Because the alcoholic like me, it's like the cat that has 7 lives. I had 6 lives. I lived my daughter's, my wife's life, and I forgot about my own. I used to control them, even if they were so small. I used to hate when my wife eat hot pepper or the food that I don't like her to eat because I don't like it. I don't want her to eat it either. Be afraid of my daughter meet the wrong people out there. Be afraid of the people like me wants that everything runs so good in the family. So protective. I like to control everybody around. I had to live the experience. When my daughter, after I came from Minneapolis 5 years ago, my second daughter, she was 18 years old. She came to me and she said, "Dad, I'm pregnant." And I didn't even know that she had a boyfriend. And that wasn't the only problem. I said, racism is for people that doesn't use his mind. When I had to live the experience, that's different. The problem to me was in my little mind that his boyfriend was black. When I did my 5th step, I went with this bridge. And I told him what happened. Because right around this time, this problem was in my home. And then I went to do my 5th step. And he said, well, everybody, all the humans, we are the same. If you take a knife, he said, and cut your skin, what are you going to find under? Everybody's make out of the same product, he said. So you are not different than anybody else, or better than anybody else. All of us came from the same place. He made me understand that. When my daughter was ready to marry, she was going to be married in this evangelical church. And my wife didn't want to go, neither do I. So I talked to my sponsors and they said, "Well, you have to go. That's the only chance that you have to prove her that you are care for her. Do you care for her? Do you love her?" So we went there. She thought that we're not going to show up. As soon as we walked in and walked into the place and she saw us, she started crying. She said, "I love you. I'm sorry. I know we didn't want this to happen this way, but I'm sorry. I really love you." So we did what we had to do. And then is when I started. Before that, we used to cry with my wife and what happened, where we went wrong. We did nothing wrong. She did nothing wrong. She did what she's supposed to do at her age. What happened is that I don't remember when I was 18 years old. To understand somebody like that, I had to level myself into the same age to understand that what happened in the home group too. And that's exactly the topics here. The spiritual meaning of the third tradition is not only let the newcomer whatever he designed to become one of us. But understand myself that he had the right to be wrong, knowing that he really needed to do something for himself. Knowing that he's going back to the bottle, he's going to destroy himself, he's probably not going to have the chance to come back to us. But I had to respect his decision. Because if I play the God's role, this world is going to be upside down. I live in the wrong house. I didn't want to live in the house that I live. I used to say I live with the wrong lady because she's not the one I wanted. I can say anything I want because she doesn't understand English. So, the problem is going to be when I get home because I want to buy the cassette and they're going to... I live in the wrong on the wrong house. This time I don't want to get into this subdivision. Tell me when, because I'm, you know, in the Hispanic group we talk a lot. Yeah. I live in the wrong house because I didn't want to go into this subdivision. I understand it well. I don't know how you're going to take it. Whatever you want to take it. I live in a really nice subdivision, and I said, we don't qualify to live there. I don't make that much money. Here you go, the commercial. I'm a carpet layer. I don't make that much. And she said, well, let's go in there. Let's try it. So we filled out some papers and then, surprise, yes, you qualify. And then I moved from Chicago to Plainfield. That's where I live. God put me in the home group where I don't want him to be. I want to be with my sponsors because I feel great in Chicago. That's the group that I came here for the first time. And then he put me in a place where we were seven people only. And they were doing everything upside down. The 12th tradition was hanging on the wall, but there was only an ornament. Nobody practiced them. I knew already a little bit of the program because I already was like a year and a half with my real great sponsors. So I started working in that home group. I took the GSR service. We are hour and 15 minutes away from Chicago. I used to drive every time. And then I started doing the sharing with all the Hispanic groups. So suddenly that group grew up. I used to pray, go to my knees and say, God, please, let me see this room filled up with people. And God probably cannot give me the lottery. Cannot give me the most beautiful lady in the world. Cannot give me the most beautiful mansion in the world. But if I pray to him and I say, I want to see the room full with people, he's going to give it to me. And he did. But I not only ask, I start working too. Now, when I sit back in that room and I see all the people all in that room, I said, thank you. It's your work. You only use me.
to do this. For a lot of people out there, we're not special. All of us, we're not special. We are unique because every one of you is different. For a lot of people out there, we're not special, but for me, I understand now that every one of you are, because before we're going to do something wrong, we think twice. Before I offend somebody or anybody, I just look into myself and I said, if you're going to hurt somebody, you are going to hurt yourself first. That's why now, every one of you is special to me. It's unique before His eyes. And thank God for that. But otherwise, just imagine, you know, that's what I'm grateful. I'm grateful to be here. I'm grateful to be part of this society. Because that's the only way that I enjoy my family. The sooner I start drinking, I start enjoying myself, start enjoying my family. And that control that I used to have, I'm not going to say that it's gone. It's still there. Every time that I have a chance, I do it again. But it's in a minor level. I'm working the steps little by little. I'm not going to run because I had plenty of time. But I still going. One day at a time. Thank you very much and God bless you.
I just want to thank all the lovely speakers who spoke this morning, and since we do have a few minutes left, I'm going to just share a little bit on Live and Let Live. Again, I'm Joyce Perry from Columbus, Ohio, and very glad to be a part of this. I am an alcoholic, and on the Live and Let Live, you know, it's been very difficult for me to finally come to the realization that I'm only responsible for myself. You know, I spent a lot of years out there drinking and trying to fix, manage, and control everybody's life. Everybody that was in my circle or in my world at that particular time, I thought I knew what was best for them, you know, and as a result, I was frustrated most of the time, disappointed a lot of the times, and very angry most of the time. You know, especially with my children. You know, I have children, two of them of which are alcoholics, and they don't mind me saying so, they have admitted it. It's just that they find it so hard to follow in my path. And I'm like, here I'm able to sponsor ladies, you know, be of service to the best of my ability, yet I'm not able to help my kids. You know, and this has been very, very hurtful to me, you know. But what I know today, that there is a God, and the same God that got me here is the same God that's going to get them here. And I'm not it. You know, all I can do is plant the seed. All I can do is be there and be helpful to anyone who may need my help. You know, but I've also found out that most people don't want your help unless they ask for it, you know. And so I had to just come and do my part, you know, do my part to take care of me, be the best person that I could be, and allow God to do the rest. You know, but it's been a very, very wonderful experience to be here today, you know, and be a part of this, because I would have never imagined in a thousand million years that I'd be standing here at a world convention behind this podium. You know, but as a result of God and some people that love me who saw that that they needed, wanted me to be a part of this, you know, here I am, you know. And I give thanks to those people and to my God, you know, and to Alcoholics Anonymous, because it has given me a life beyond anything that I could have ever imagined, you know. And all I have to do is continue showing up, suiting up, doing the best that I can, and leaving the rest to God, you know. And everything will fall into place if I learn and practice that those principles in my life on a daily basis. And this is what I have discovered, this is what I've been taught, and I know that this to be true. You know, that we have some principles that we have to live by. And as a result of living by them, our life, our thinking, everything begins to change for me. And it has. I've been able to see that. You know, and I've had significant others. I've had different many relationships, you know, all of them unhealthy, you know, because I didn't know how to live, you know. I just didn't know how to live. And here I was out there trying to tell someone else how to live, and I wasn't even living the way that I needed to be living, you know. So as a result of two men getting together and founding Alcoholics Anonymous and God-oriented, here I am today, you know, able to take care of me, to refer back to God on a regular basis to get me through each day, you know, to do the best that I can to support others and to and for myself, you know. Just allow people to be where they're at, you know. And it doesn't mean I love them any less. It just means that they have a right to make their own mistakes, to learn from their own experiences, and to grow like I am growing today. I want to thank you all for being here, and I'd like for us to close with the Lord's Prayer.